Hello, I am the non-existent Russian cricketer Pablo Chuckfish, and you are listening to the Cricket Sadist Hour.
That is the name of the show. I am Jared Kimber. Alongside me is perhaps the most underrated swing bowler in his family, Sandy Zaltzman.
Hello, Jared. I did once take the new ball for my village team, and we had our captain in Sunday friendlies was something of a laissez-faire tactician, where basically, if you took the new ball, you'd basically bowl until you demanded to be taken off. And I bowled a 13-over opening spell. Bear in mind, I've never taken more than 3 wickets in an innings in my life at any level of the game. Bear in mind that the levels of the game I've played at are about as low as you can get. And I bowled a 13-over spell of very slow outswing.
If
I got it 1 for 75.
There's no way we could have found a better expert to talk about Jimmy Anderson than you today.
Hi, I'm the late West Indian batting legend George Henley, and you're listening to the Cricket Sadist Hour.
I'm going to start with Robin Peterson's story, which is where most people start their Jimmy Anderson.
It's where most people start most things in life, isn't it? Robin Peterson's story.
Champions Trophy in 2013. For some reason, South Africa were using Robin Peterson as a pinch hitter. I still don't remember why, but they obviously had a reason behind it that maybe Robin could tell us. I don't know. But Jimmy Anderson was bowling to him, and he's bowling right arm around the wicket. Peterson's left-handed. So Anderson's bowling around the wicket. He's bowling outswingers to the left-handed Peterson. And I think Peterson might have played and missed at one or two, but he'd left a couple. But the thing is, it was just such an obvious plan that what he was trying to do is just move Peterson across in front of his stumps. And suddenly he just swings one the other way, gets him out, I think LBW or bowled straight away. And it was just, you see with really top class spinners, they move the batsman into the position that they want in order to get the wicket. It's very rare that you see it at the very top level for seam bowlers.
Well, I saw his first test wicket live. Yeah, it was. I mean, he was an interesting bowler as a youngster. That he'd already played one day as in Australia, including a spell of 1 for 12 in 10 overs. So everyone was quite excited about it. He bowled. You know, he looked clearly a good bowler, and he cleaned up Mark Vermeulen. I don't think he was the only bowler ever to clean up Mark Vermeulen, but and
famous,
took five
for other things. I think Mark Vermeulen these days.
And then I took my son to Lord's last summer, and he took 7 for 42 against West Indies, which is his best innings figures in tests in the game in which he took his 500th. And there was his 500th wicket was almost identical to his first one. And given the rather circuitous journey he'd taken as an international cricketer in between those two wickets, it was quite a striking resemblance.
I remember, I think the strongest memory I have is the 50 overs he bowled at Trent Bridge in the 2013 Ashes.
Yeah, which is probably his most important bowling as an England.
He bowled 35% of England's overs in that game, which is quite a lot for a seam bowler.
Yeah. And took 5 in each innings.
Yeah.
And was then pretty much knackered and didn't do much in the rest of the series.
Well, it gets worse. I think he averaged something like 47 or something for his next 8 tests or whatever. But I just remember, like, so at Trent Bridge, the press box is just right behind the bowler's arm. And just watching him, he just looked dead.
Yeah.
And he just kept coming in. And you just knew that chances were he was going to be the one to do it. No one else in England really looked that like they were going to get the wicket. And he finally, I think he got Haddon out caught behind. Yeah, he's just, I think for modern cricket fans, he's just been around for so long. Like, he's had this incredibly long career, hasn't he? And if I'm not mistaken, Andy, he might also be the batsman who has been not out in the most losses in Test match cricket.
Stop it, it's the drinks break. Carry on.
At his best, he's very, very good.
Why we're doing a podcast.
I don't think I'm going out on a limb when I say that. So he's had various phases in his career. I wrote a piece for the Wisden Almanac, for this year's Wisden Almanac, which I broke down his career into 5 phases, and this was up to the end of the 2017 summer. It's hard to interpret what he's done in the 2017-18 winter, which has been okay, whether that's the start of a new phase or a little dip within the his great phase. History will be the judge. So in the first of these five phases...
Phase one.
Let's call it phase one, phase A, phase Aleph. If you want to go with the Hebrew alphabet, that's a nod to my family heritage. 20 test matches up to December 2007, when he took an absolute hammering in Sri Lanka. 62 wickets, average 39, economy rate 3.7.
As a cricket writer, I think I'm in a position to say, not great.
Not great. At that point in his career, he had a very similar record to Chris Lewis and Pedro Collins, neither of whom have taken 500 test wickets, I think it's fair to say.
Pedro Collins was robbed.
Neither of whom are up there in the highest echelons of elite seam bowling.
Can we do an episode on Pedro Collins?
And there have been moments. So he took that five wickets on debut against Zimbabwe in his fifth test. He took five against South Africa, including becoming the only bowler ever to bowl Jack Callis twice in the same test. And no other bowler hit Callis's stumps more than twice in his entire career. Anderson bowled him out twice in the one test match. Promise, but massively inconsistent and generally expensive.
Yeah.
Phase two then comes from his recall in New Zealand early in 2008. He replaces Hoggard, and Hoggard is discarded after fairly harshly by the selectors, but they brought in Anderson. He'd had he'd done some good things against India in the summer of 2007, but hadn't established himself. He then becomes basically a consistent pick for England, but over the next 3 years, up to the South Africa series of 2009-2010, when he did okay, 94 wickets in 26 tests, average 31.9. So decent, but again, there's no sign that he's going to become one of the greatest English bowlers of all time. Then in the 2010 summer, which was a great summer for swing bowling, and Pakistanis did very well before being a bit naughty, up into to April 2012, when he did very well in Sri Lanka, 22 tests, 102 wickets, average 23, and an economy rate of 2.7. So he's basically become a completely different bowler.
Yeah,
that he's maintained his wicket taking threat, but he's now reliable, consistent, and gets wickets through pressure as well as the magic balls that he always had in his armoury. Then a slight dip, which includes that 2013 Ashes when he had arguably his greatest match, but over 24 tests from the summer of 2012 up to the end of the 2013-14 Ashes, which I believe England did not win from memory.
We'll have to check.
There were allegations that it was a 5-0 whitewash, but that's never been proved. So in that almost 2 year period, 2012 to early 2014, 24 matches, 85 wickets, average 32.2. So again, still decent, but tailed off.
Remember, he got smashed by George Bailey at Perth for 24 or 26. I can't even remember how many runs, but a lot of runs in that over. You know, it just felt like at that stage that was maybe the end of Jimmy Anderson.
So in that sort of first peak he'd had a great series in Australia. I think 26 wickets, average in the mid-20s. But, you know, that doesn't really reveal the extent of the impact he had in that series. He was very good in India, particularly in the Calcutta test match, that England won to go 2-1 up in the series. So then you might have thought, by the end of that 2013-14 Ashes, the England team had clearly reached a fairly abrupt, not so much a bump in the road as a tectonic fault in the road, Superman style. And you'd have thought, you know, Anderson could have been one of the ones that was on his way out. His returns had been diminishing. However, between then and the end of the 2017 summer, 37 tests, 163 wickets, average 20, with 9 5 wicket hauls and an economy rate of 2.5, which is handy and puts him, in terms of players' peaks, up there with almost anyone in the history of Test cricket. So he's had an undulating career, and you know, the best of Anderson. You know, he might not have been as consistently good over his entire career as other bowlers, but peak Anderson is pretty damn good.
It's really interesting, like just the different kinds of bowler he has been, because he was, I think you said before, the magic ball bowler. He was almost like Mark Wood when he started, really. So he swung it a bit more, but he had that sort of energy and this sort of, you know, he would bounce through the crease and the ball would do all these things, but it didn't look like he had any control over it. And then to go from that to what he is now, one of the most accurate bowlers of the last 5 years, who seems to be able to swing the ball at will at the right amount, not just the random amount. It's not even a similar bowler. And you see that a lot with batsmen. I'm not sure you see it as much with bowlers where they have two completely different careers. Remember Michael Clarke? And he came in and was playing all these big shots and then became, quite a steady batsman later on. And then Steve Waugh was another one. Really attacking,
Ken Barrington even, who became one of the dullest batsmen in the history of cricket, but also one of the most effective, had begun as a bit of a dasher, had a couple of failed tests for England in 1955 and basically restructured his entire game and became a completely different and far more effective player.
Sean Pollock, maybe the only bowler I could think of recent times, who was a completely different kind of bowler from the beginning of his career to the end of his career. But as you said with Anderson, there's almost like three different periods maybe even that he's had.
And Pollock was, I guess, partly due to ageing and possibly injuries. He was really quick.
He was quick.
And famous for his helmet-shaking bounces as a youngster.
Didn't he hit Mike Atherton's helmet 15 times in the first two deliveries he bowled to?
Yeah, first three overs, I think it was. England were on, I think, 60 for naught with 58 leg byes. I'll have to check the stats on that. Fascinating career. His most important series, the 2010-11 Ashes, I think in terms of his impact on the series, again, not entirely revealed by the stats.
Broad went home after the second test.
He took like one wicket in the series, I think. Then Tremlett and Bresnan came in and did very well. But Anderson was making key breakthroughs early, particularly in that Adelaide test when England came off after that first test when they'd saved the game. Mm. And then suddenly they're all over Australia and they've turned the series, essentially.
Yeah, it's... when you think about it now, looking back, like Bresnan hasn't gone on to be a big test success. I know his elbow was part of the problem. Tremlett could never really recover that kind of form again as well. So without Anderson, they really wouldn't have even got close. And yet they dominated that series and he was just an incredible bowler.
Well, I mean, we talked about that Trent Bridge in 2013. That was an elongated spell. But, I mean, there have been lots at home where, he's been pretty much unplayable. And that one at Lords last summer against West Indies, they're not the greatest batting side, but they put up a pretty determined show in that game and had won the previous test match.
I mean,
he bowled phenomenally well.
Yeah, he took a bunch of wickets against Sri Lanka the last time Sri Lanka were here at Headingley.
Yeah.
It felt like you were watching everyone else was a test bowler and he was that next, thing. We've talked about his record being up and down, but when he's at his best, he's just... To use cricket speak, he's elite.
Elite, yeah.
Cricket! Cricket! Do as you're told, you naughty little blighter! Eat your dinner!
The Cricket Sages Hour!
Because he's played for so long, he's actually had quite an interesting history. Because when he started off, he was thought of as a one-day bowler. And did incredible. Do you remember right early on in his career, it seemed like he could swing the white ball like a foot further than he could the red ball. He was a professional cricketer from the age of 18, obviously from Lancashire, which as an Australian, we only really ever respected Lancashire or Yorkshire cricketers. This is before Durham.
Right.
Now it's three counties.
Right. What about Nottingham? What about Harold Lowell and Bill Bowden?
Two south. Okay. The accents aren't as good. But he was always quite... But he didn't really look like a typical Lancashire cricketer. Like a typical Lancashire cricketer looks like Liam Plunkett looks now to me. Whereas he looked like... I mean, Jimmy Anderson did look like he just got lost from a boy band and somehow stumbled into the middle. And he didn't have great control. But he certainly was a decent one-day cricketer. I don't know if he was ever... he was never a top-flight one-day cricketer, I don't think. Do you think?
I've not looked so much at his one-day... his one-day career. He had was inconsistent early on. Had that amazing spell that we mentioned in Australia in early 2003, and had a good World Cup just after that. Thereafter, when he was a very good test bowler, he was also a very good one-day bowler, but he was terrible in World Cups. And I don't know if there's a reason for this.
Because he's English? Are you saying because he's English?
Malaise that comes across England cricketers whenever they go to a World Cup opening ceremony or just hear the words World Cup. And they just all get 85% rubbisher. So he had very poor World Cups in 07, 2011 and 2015. But had been a very good one-day bowler then.
There's a couple of really interesting things in his history that I find. So, for a guy who's gone on to be quite a good Ashes player, his first Ashes, 06-07, he took 5 wickets at 82. And I don't think, even in the bad days of English cricket, there were many cricketers who were just given as much abuse from the fans for just being rubbish as he was. Yeah. And his first 36 tests...
So, in slight mitigation, England picked him for that series after he'd missed basically the entire English summer.
Oh, yeah. That
He played, I think, one first-class game and bowled 10 overs or something. It was
pretty good 10 overs, though.
It was an insane selection. And, you know, at that point, he wasn't a good test bowler. He wasn't fit. And... he took 5 wickets at 82.
So, Anderson, for the first 36 tests, he averaged over 35 in a country where wickets fall more often than around the test world, which is not great. Then England tried to make him quicker. The, was it Troy Cooley world? And instead, they almost ended him forever. And then the really interesting thing for me is that most modern English cricketers are defined by their 2005-ness.
Yeah.
And he missed it.
Yeah.
He's been playing cricket since, like, you were young. And yet, he missed the series when everything was going on, partly because they thought he wasn't quick enough, which, now looking back on it, is ridiculous. But quite an interesting thing about his history, isn't it? That he just wasn't there for that incredible moment. And... when you look at him in total, so from the 12th of May 2009 until now, he's taken 407 wickets at 25. In some ways, he's like the modern story of an English cricketer. Professional from 18, works really hard, has, as you said, has this really weird random career, which it seems like a lot of English cricketers have, all these different phases. They had what was one of the world's best swing bowlers, and they tried to make him into a quick bowler. And then he then comes back and has incredible series where at home and away where he's really important. But then other times when he's quite average as well, there aren't many players who get mentioned as great as much as him and have as many poor series as James Anderson has had. So his history is quite patchy, I think, overall.
Yeah, overall, yeah, I think that's fair. And also, he doesn't have a great record in 5 tests. Series. He's had some really good ones, but several where he's been not massively effective.
You're saying he gets tired?
Well, I don't know if that's the case. He doesn't, I mean, in fourth and fifth games of series, he's averaging over 30.
Okay. I noticed as a writer, I tire by the fourth test sometimes. I still get the words out there, Andy. They're obviously gold.
Yeah.
They just don't come as quick.
Right.
And they're not as pretty.
Right. Not as shiny gold.
Yeah. But, okay, that's an interesting thing, especially because it was the Mega Ashes when he really struggled, when it was that first test where he bowled himself into the ground, and then 9 other tests where he wasn't as good as he usually would be.
Yeah. I guess within any player there's statistical quirks. Clearly, he's, over the course of his career, been very good in England. We'll get more onto his overseas stats in a bit. And in particular in the early summer series... So if you compare him and Broad from 2008 onwards, when they both became regulars in the team, in the early summer series, Anderson has taken has averaged 19 and Broad 28. In the late summer series, Anderson's averaged 25 and Broad 26. So Anderson's still effective in late summer.
You're not saying he's a dud. You're just saying he's incredible in the early.
Yeah.
Is that perhaps because the ball swings a little bit more in the early part of the summer? And also, some of those teams, there's been a lot of subcontinental teams who've had to play, you know, really early on.
I think it's a mixture of both of those things. And, you know, he's had the type of bowling that exploits, though, you know, any technical weakness against moving deliveries. One more slightly quirky stat about Anderson. He's been he's bowled in 11 innings in which England have conceded more than 600. You talk about the...
It's weird, isn't it? Sometimes you hear something and you go, that's probably the tombstone, isn't it?
You can't score runs in the pavilion unless you have a very long bat. And even then, it is difficult.
That was Sir Archibald Range, reading from T.S. Eliot's previously unpublished collection of poems about cricket, entitled Smash the Damn Thing for Six. And next week.
Most people, when they point to Anderson's weakness, generally talk to his overseas record. It's interesting, there's a lot of really, really good players, someone like Harbhajan Singh, maybe even Mitchell Johnson, Vernon Philander, who get sort of tarnished with this. Tell me, Andy, how good was he overseas?
Again, this needs to be broken down into phases, and they're not quite the same as his overall phases. In total...
Are we going phases within phases?
Phases within phases. We're recording this after England's first test in New Zealand, so this may have changed. But 59 tests, 191 wickets, average 32.8 away from home, and only 5 out of his 25 five-wicket hauls. By comparison, Dale Steyn, 176 wickets, average 24 in his 39 tests outside South Africa. But again, if you break it down, there's sort of three phases for his away record, and I'm including neutral matches in the UAE. His first 19 away tests, 52 wickets, average 43.
Okay, so that's a young man struggling with his game.
Yeah. The next 28, so this is from the 2010-11 Ashes, which was really his first major overseas success, to the end of the Pakistan series in late 2015 in the UAE. 108 wickets, average 27, including 43 wickets, average 23 in Asia.
That's incredible. That's Steyn levels of Singh bowling in Asia, isn't it? Which is really tough, I think. I think people forget how tough it is for, in the same ways that it's so tough for Asian spinners to come to non-Asian conditions. It's just as tough for the seamers. But both sides, like Harbhajan Singh and Jimmy Anderson, if they have any success outside of their home, they should be given some credit there.
Since the start of the South Africa series that began late in 2015, he has taken 31 wickets in 12 tests, an average of 34, so an economy of 2.3. So he's kept it tight, and I think we saw in the recent Ashes, Australia basically just defended Anderson and essentially blunted him. He had an ineffective series, had reasonable stats, but his wickets didn't have much impact on shaping games. So if you took a look at the peak period away from home, that 108 wickets, average 27 in 28 test matches, compared with his record at home at the same time, was 130 wickets, average 26. So he had almost identical records home and away for a five-year period.
That's incredible.
Yeah. Since then, however, he's, as I said, his away record averaging 34, but at home, 69 wickets in the last two home summers, average 14. So there's been this bizarre divergence that he was basically as effective home and away over a five-year period. Since then, he's been better than he's ever been in England, but fairly ordinary overseas. It hasn't helped that England have been struggling, and he's been the bowler that the opposition have most looked to blunt.
Mm.
So I think he's more accurate than he was, but also teams, I think, take very few risks against him because they don't fear the rest of England's bowling attack. Now, this coincides with when he stopped playing one-day international cricket. So in the 2015 World Cup, was basically that was him.
How did England go in that one?
I can't remember. We nearly won it. If we'd only won another like four or five games, they could easily have ended up.
Could have gone either way.
Yes, on such narrow, slender threads do the fates hang. I wonder if him stopping but playing one international cricket has had an impact on his test match bowling, in that he can focus purely on test match skills, test match lines and lengths and the red ball. And that's made him more effective in England. Whereas overseas, because he's not playing one-day cricket, he's maybe not working on his variations as much maybe he's losing some of the flexibility and changes in his bowling that made him so effective, particularly in Asia during that period, or it might just be a statistical glitch. What do you reckon?
Yeah, I mean, he's getting older as well, isn't he? And it's easier to be a seam bowler in England to a very late age. You don't see a lot of old killer swing bowlers in Australia and South Africa and, you know, India and places like that, because it's not as easy. You know, in England or maybe New Zealand, you probably could go on until 38, 39. So maybe it's just that when you lose that little bit of extra bit of speed and bounce, and he's not massively slower than he used to be, but it might just be that that's enough. My theory on modern test bowlers is that we have new ball bowlers and we have middle overs bowlers, and maybe he's just as good as he used to be with the middle with the new ball, but with the slightly older ball in the middle, he just maybe loses the pace and the bounce and, you know, the ability to, you know, he used to be able to bounce people out. He can't really do things like that, and maybe that's what you need. You need a little bit more variety when you travel overseas. But yet again, I don't know, it could be a glitch. Having explained all of those...
Yes, well, there are many stats that people tend to read too much into that are just little glitches. Now, you mentioned him as a new ball and an old ball bowler. There was one interesting quirk that came out of my research into...
Is this phase three?
Into no, this is I haven't broken this down into phases. But I've broken it down into phases of innings. So, 20-over chunks of test match innings. This is just from the 2010 summer to date. So when he really became a top-class...
Yeah.
Test bowler. He's averaged 24 in the first 20 overs of innings, which is the 7th best out of the 25 bowlers who bowled most deliveries in that phase of innings. 21 in overs 21 to 40. He's the best bowler from the 21st to the 40th over, which surprised me a bit, because you think of him as a new ball bowler who most effective right at the start of the innings.
In that list, how many of those players are English?
I would have to check that, Jared.
Because the reason I ask that is the juke ball swings longer, which helps the seamers more, and also the conditions of England allow for new balls to be a little bit more potent for longer.
Okay, well,
I don't know if that's just a juke thing. I think any ball in England would just be a little bit better for a little bit longer.
If you put some incidental music on, I can check that for you right now.
Bum, bum. Bum, bum. Bum, bum.
Right, I have an answer for you, Jared.
Please.
These stats were...
Are they fresh?
They're almost fresh. I was researching these during the Ashes, so they might have slightly tweaked. The top bowlers in overs 21 to 40 of Test cricket since June of 2010. Anderson top, as I said, averaging 21.1 when I looked this up. This is in terms of average. Next, Graham Swan averaged 24... And here's a very odd statistical quirk. Graham Swan, spinner, you'd expect him to be at his most effective later in the innings. He is the least effective of the 25 bowlers who have bowled most balls from over 61 to 80 in Test cricket this decade. He averages 59. Swan, he averaged 59 in over 61 to 80 of Test innings. That surprised me.
We've always said about Swan, he just wasn't a softball man.
So, but very good earlier in the innings. So Swan second, Jadeja third, then Hazelwood, Ashwin, Neil Wagner, Dale Steyn, Southee, Johnson, Broad is the next.
So it's not real. That just seems to be that he's swinging the ball longer than, isn't he, Anderson, rather than anyone else. Which is, that was one of the other things me and George Dobell talk about a lot when we're watching England is. Even when the other bowlers are doing well and the team's flying, when Anderson comes back on for that second spell, it really feels like something is happening. Whereas with Broad, Broad either gets himself up or doesn't get himself up. Very rarely does it happen out of his hand the way that it does for Anderson.
I missed one out. So the next phase of innings is 41 to 60. Anderson has averaged 26.4 this decade. That puts him sixth out of the 25 most regular bowlers in that period, so he's still pretty good. Over 61 to 80, he's averaging 34. That's 18th out of those 25 bowlers, still ahead of Graham Swan by a considerable distance. But clearly a significant dip. Doesn't bowl that much then, but still not very effective. Then over 81 to 100, he averages 23. That puts him 11th out of the top 25. And from over 101 onwards, averaging still 23. That's fifth on the list. So he's... I thought it was interesting how the peak... His peak within breaking the 20 over blocks was not over 1 to 20, but 21 to 40.
But also, like, just from that, sounds like he's quite a threat all the way, which would make sense, because to take 500 wickets, you couldn't just be first 25 overs. You'd have to be all the way through.
Also, it's just that he's not ever fully mastered reverse swing, given that in over 61 to 80, he has quite a poor record.
But is that potentially because the Duke usually reverses earlier?
Look, Jared, if we start analysing every single stat, I'm never going to leave my house.
If you could give me a phase within a phase within a phase, I would be able to get this.
The best bowler in overs 61 to 80?
Paul Collingwood.
Dale Steyn.
What a shock. Although Paul Collingwood is unlucky.
You're listening to Baseball Today, the cricket version.
So, yeah, the next big thing is whether Jimmy Anderson is overrated or not, which is a big knock on him. And it's an interesting thing because he has bowled through one of the greatest batting eras of all time and taken 500 wickets with swing bowling, considering there's almost no swing bowlers left on the planet. There are bowlers who can swing it, but very few swing bowlers. You know what I mean there.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's managed 500 wickets. He's overcome the worst of sports coaching to do that. And yet there's a lot of talk about him being overrated. He's compared to Dale Steyn a lot. I think it's important. And, we should do an episode just on Dale Steyn maybe further on. Dale Steyn is great. Dale Steyn is one of the greatest bowlers who has ever lived. He is certainly in the top 10 bowlers of all time. Yes.
Yeah, and particularly, again, if you compare him with his direct contemporaries, I think he stands out more from his contemporaries, possibly than any other bowler since the First World War. Any other pace bowler, since the First World War.
No, I think that's fair. His record away from home, which is just wrong.
Yes,
it's wrong.
Morally unacceptable.
The fact that he's had such a low bowling average in an era when batsmen are just averaging 50 for fun. You average 52 in Test cricket.
No, I did have one season in village cricket where I averaged 50, but...
Nice of you to slip that in. But I suppose the comparison I've made in the past is that Dale Steyn is Superman.
Yeah.
And what Anderson is Batman. Where, realistically, if they were to fight in a film, obviously Superman would always win because he's an alien.
Yeah.
And Superman always wins. Whereas Batman, he's having to make the most of what he's got. I'm not sure Anderson is the most... the other problem was people called him the most skillful bowler.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not sure he is the most skillful bowler of his era because I think Muhammad Asif and Stuart Clarke were probably more skillful than him. But in some ways, I can see why he might be seen as more skillful than Dale Steyn. Dale Steyn can do everything great. Jimmy Anderson can do fewer things great. But the things that he is great at, I think there's no one even close to being as good a swing bowler as him in the modern era.
Yes, and I guess I also... depends on your definition of what skill is and skillful. And I think...
Have you had a phase about this?
Not a phase. Who was it that described him as the most... It was on England's holding. Was it Troy?
Was it Botham?
It might have been David Saker. I can't remember.
Oh, okay. It's been said a lot, though, now, hasn't it? Yeah.
But I guess, if you're looking at... I think what he was referring to was his manipulation of a ball.
Yeah.
Clearly, there's a skill in bowling at 92 miles an hour, which... Steyn had
with the control of Steyn as well, yeah.
So I guess it depends how you interpret skill, but I could see his point. He wasn't saying he was a better bowler than Steyn or a more effective bowler than Steyn.
Well, no one's that's the funny thing is, no one's actually ever really said that about Anderson. Realistically, there's a lot of advantages that Dale Steyn gets by playing short series that Anderson doesn't get, but there's also a lot of advantages that Anderson gets by playing longer series. I mean, if you talk to test batsmen who make their debuts, the first thing that they realise is by the time they get to their second or third test, they've got to face the best bowlers in the world who've now completely worked them out.
Yeah.
That never happens in first class cricket because you don't play someone week in, week out, week in, week out. You play them once at the start of the season and then once again maybe in the middle or the end. So there's a lot of advantages that Anderson has had, and a lot of advantages that Steyn has had. Realistically, Steyn's record, you have to take him out of any conversation with Anderson. If you compare Anderson to every other normal human bowler in this era, he is an incredible bowler. He might be, and these are the sort of nonsense conversations that people have, he might be a bit like Mahela Jayawardena and Michael Clarke. He might be a English great rather than a great great. But that doesn't mean he's not an incredible player.
Yes, and well, if we go back to players' peaks, which I'm quite obsessed with statistically, because as I think some players, you know, do very well from the fact that they didn't, you know, they came into Test cricket later, they didn't have failures as a youngster, or, you know, retired early, so they didn't tail off and get worse and worse. Anderson's top 40 matches, 175 wickets at an average of 20. Now, Steyn's best average over 40 matches was also 20. His most wickets was 223, averaged 20.9. So I think one metric that Steyn has, even, you know, comparing their peaks, their average is similar. Steyn higher wickets per match, which again slightly comes down to the balance of the bowling attack. But yeah, I mean, I don't think anyone would claim Anderson was a better or greater bowler than Dale Steyn, but it doesn't mean he's not objectively. It's borderline all-time great.
Clearly, do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I mean, it's slightly semantic. But
it's a nonsense argument, right? Yeah. But it is the argument that cricket fans have over and over again. And you know that I think a bit like Mahela and Michael Clarke, that there are just problems within their overall records. And there's a lot of guys out there that are, there are a lot of players out there that are incredible that are just not all time greats. And then there are all time greats according to their numbers who aren't really remembered that well. Herbert Sutcliffe. Yeah. Is one. Barrington's not given a lot of credit considering his average. So there's a lot that goes into it. Like the fact that Victor Trumper is still talked about now, despite his low average, tells you a lot about him as a player. And, you know, it's all nonsensical.
Yeah.
But I get the feeling that as good as Anderson has been, he'll still never live up to the 2005 bowling attack that he wasn't allowed to be a part of. Do you know? And that's absolutely nothing to do with him. So he's been compared to the greatest test series of all time that he was ruined for and missed, and wasn't fast enough for. And he's been compared to Dale Steyn. But if you actually look at him and say he has bowled in a career where batsmen have dominated, and he has managed to stay. So here's one for you. Post-World War II, there have been only Courtney Walsh, Kapil Dev, Richard Hadlee, Wasim Akram, Ian Botham, Imran Khan, Shaminder Bas, and Sarfraz Nawaz, who have had longer careers than him.
Right.
It is very hard for a seamer to have a long career in general. And some of those guys obviously had all-round skills as well, which maybe helped them towards the end.
Yes.
They could keep making runs. I'm not saying that's 100%. It might have even got them into the team earlier when they were younger. But realistically, for a guy with no all-round skills, good fielder, but you know what I mean.
got 81 against India in a test match.
Oh, he's there. It's horrible. You know, essentially, he's had, you know, just to stay there for as long as he had. And if you think of, like, English cricket in 2002 was a completely different species to what... Like, he's lived through one of the weirdest and sometimes best, sometimes weird, oddest period of English cricket. They played so much more. At one stage, I don't know if this is still the case, but one stage he had bowled more seam balls in a 5-year period than anyone else has. I don't think anyone's broken his record since then. So he bowled more than anyone else in Test cricket ever, and he's managed to... How many coaches have you had in that time? 40?
It's basically done by jury service for a while.
And a lot of captains as well. And completely, if you think, you know, the ECB has changed as an organisation in that time. You know, he lived through the Moneyball era. Then there was that We Hate Data era. Then there's the Trevor Bayliss, we're just going to, you know, drive through the fog at top speed era. Like, it's, you know, for him just to last that shows the overall talent that he has.
Yes. Oh, I mean, I think alongside that, it's in terms of having a long career, this is the best time to be an England player because they've had central contracts.
Oh, yeah, financially.
They've looked after their players physically much better than they ever did. In fact, you're far less likely to have injury problems if you're within the England setup than playing county cricket. I don't know if the stats would back that up. You know, how different would, say, you know, Darren Goff's career have been had he just been a little bit later and had more support? So, I mean, I think up until this big late peak that we've talked about with Anderson, you know, if you compare Anderson with Goff, who would you have taken up to, say, you know, 2015 at their best?
Well,
their stats for their peak times were not that dissimilar.
Well, the interesting thing about them is you'd want both of those kinds of bowlers in your team, wouldn't you? Because they're very complementary. In fact, Broad and Anderson and Goff and Caddick, very complementary as well. I'm just going to pull you up on when I said that the bowlers were the longest careers, though. Almost all of those guys are from previous eras.
Yeah.
I mean, Vaas is the only one who has really come from this era. So it is interesting that we haven't had, you know, England are not the only professional team. New Zealand have been quite professional. Australia, South Africa, India are obviously really professional now as well. And some of the other teams are starting to get to those levels as well. And yet we still only had Anderson.
Yes. And I mean, I think he's a prodigious natural athlete from what everyone says. And having, once they stopped tinkering with his action and getting him injured, then, you know, that's, I think, one of the reasons for his longevity, that he's looked after himself and he has a natural physique that's supported him through it. In terms of the greatest English bowlers of all time, you're looking at the best 40 matches in terms of, wickets and average. Anderson's, like I said, 175 wickets, average 20.8. Freddie Trueman, 200 wickets, average 20.7. Ian Botham, 201, average 20.9. The best, Jim Laker, over quite a prolonged, over an 11-year period, because he was in and out of the team, 169 wickets, not as many wickets, average 90.4. So, I mean, he is right up there with the top English
bowlers. And you haven't mentioned Sid Barnes, who probably is the best bowler. Well,
he only played 27.
No, of course, tests. But you know what I mean. Yeah. Like, Barnes is probably the gold standard. I mean,
but Anderson took 100 wickets at an average of 17 up to the end of the 2017 summer, which is basically Barnes' level average. Yeah.
So, look, he certainly has to be at the very top. And there is also, we've talked about it a lot, but there's no doubt that being a swing bowler in England is a huge advantage to have. Yeah. And he has had that. My question is, was he the more important player during England's really great run in Test cricket, or was Swan?
That's a tough one. I think Swan was the most influential England cricketer probably since Botham. Since Botham at his best, because of he was basically the English Warne in terms of his role within the team, lower order, counter-attacking batsman, slip fielder.
Attitude
and an attacking and defensive, a spinner who would take wickets and not get hit, so he offered control and penetration. Not saying he was as good as Warne, but in terms of his function within the team, it was almost identical. So I think the fact that he was so much more multidimensional, and England, you know, hadn't had a great spinner since the 50. Well, since Derek Underwood, and a great right arm spinner probably since Laker. I think probably makes him the more important cricketer for England.
No, I think so too. And it's interesting because he had a shorter career, Swan.
Yes.
And because he hasn't gone on to get the great mathematical numbers. But if, you know, in, it, once Swan went, the impact of Swan going, I think, would have had a bigger crater than had Anderson gone. And that's not to say that Anderson isn't a huge part of that as well.
It's an interesting stat that I found out while researching this piece on Anderson for Wisden. He has much better stats bowling with Moeen Ali in the team than with Swan.
That makes sense, though. Swan is annoying.
But I think part of it was that Moeen Ali plus Stokes coming in at roughly the same time, and England had to have a five-man attack. So there's maybe slightly less pressure on him. And again, it might just be a bit of a quirk.
Yeah.
That said, there have been some striking sort of one-match failures that Anderson's had. We saw last summer that when West Indies won at Headingley and chased 330-odd, was it? And Sheho batted like a prince. Anderson was unable to have any effect on that. There was the... we saw in Adelaide in the recent Ashes, England totally failed to take advantage of really helpful conditions.
Once he took his wicket, the game was almost over.
Lords in 2014 against India, England had first use of a really helpful pitch and they just didn't get it right. So that even within his great period, there have been matches where he's been significantly less good than a bowler of his calibre ought to have been. I don't know. I mean, every bowler has those, but I don't know how many Steyn has had of those. I think not many.
I did some research on this a few years ago where Steyn almost doesn't have a bad series, like let alone a bad test. He just doesn't have bad series.
And McGrath was the same. McGrath had, I think, one when he was a constant in the Australian team, 1 year where he averaged over 23.
Yeah, and that's the difference. But I've got no problem with saying that Anstead is an incredible bowler without not comparing him to McGrath. He's probably also not as good as Malcolm Marshall.
Yes.
Or Imran at his best, yeah. But he's been incredible.
When I think of all those people who lived and died before cricket was invented, it makes me weep tears of despair. That was a real potential market untapped financially.
I've had a test match legend who said to me, he was the worst person I ever played against. I hate him with a passion. I hate him, I hate him, I hate him.
Right.
To paraphrase, there might have been other words in there as well. He is the master of sledging under his hand. Do you think that will come across? Anyway, he's the master of sledging under his hand. He's really brutal with his sledges. I mean, you know, it's quite funny to hear him come out against the Australians because I think he basically sledges more like an Australian than he does like an English player. You know, as you were sort of alluding to before, he's had this, you know, he was maybe one of the first fully professional top-level cricketers outside of Australia, so he's had all the advantages. England haven't always been the good news team, you know, internationally. There's still a lot of colonial angst out there. But, you know, I wonder how much his personality sort of plays into that as well. He's a really good villain. Andy.
Yes.
He is a really good villain.
So that's, I guess that, again, that's a non-English perspective on him. I met him only once. I did a day of test match special with him last summer. He was, seemed delightful, frankly. But I guess as sports fans and sports watchers, we, you know, judge players on how they behave on the pitch, and
he doesn't give a lot off the pitch either. Yeah. He's not a big celebrity like some of the other guys.
He doesn't seek the limelight,
Which means that we can only judge him to a certain extent on the pitch, or when you're commentating with him on BBC, or when I make a slightly inappropriate comment at a dinner.
When you can no more judge someone from what they're like in a commentary box than because they're at work, and you know, what I'm saying is, I don't know him, but. I guess, as if he's not on your team, and there is a stroppiness about him a lot, and I think it's been a slight issue with English cricket in the last couple of years that him and Broad have tended to get a bit stroppy a bit too quickly in the field when things aren't going
well. Have you got a stroppy strike rate for me?
I don't. There's not a strop filter on Stats Guru yet.
Sadly.
Regrettably. So I guess, you know, if he's not... If he's not on your team, I'd imagine he could be not a player you'd instinctively warm to.
And he's one of the first players that... So, I think if you really
But I think he's very popular. He seems to be... You know, he's popular with England fans, not just because of his achievements, but... he seems like a humble and, you know, fairly quiet guy.
But if you're a 35-year-old English fan, he's basically been your entire life at this point. So you can understand why he would be quite popular as well. And, you know, he's he can be tough, which is a thing that fans like. But I think it, and I suppose what I'm trying to get to is, since Crick Info and the internet in general, you now have the ability to be seen worldwide with all of your actions, and so you have these sort of global like reputations. And I think that he's going to be someone who he might go on to have a really good post career. Seems like a clever guy when he does do a little bit of the media stuff, and he can certainly talks through bowling pretty well. But I don't think, a bit like Matt Hayden, I think Matt Hayden thought everyone liked him around the world until he started hearing that he didn't. I think there's a bit of that with James Anderson as well.
But often, you know, sort of Glenn McGrath, as an English cricket fan, I mean, everyone hated Glenn McGrath because he was, maybe in a similar way, he was stroppy and also annoyingly good. And so we're listening to him commentate now. He seems like a really nice guy. And it's really disappointing as a fan that you have these villains and you want them to live up to that.
Yeah. And I don't think Anderson... I suppose that's what another thing I'm trying to say is that I don't think Anderson will. And it would be interesting to see how he is... you know, because there are certain players who drop off. So John Snow, for instance, who was an incredible bowler for England, no one talks. I'm the first person to mention Jon Snow in a non-Game of Thrones reference in a very long time in this country. And it's, you know, you get that a lot. You get these players drop off. It'd be interesting to see as if Test cricket keeps getting played at the limit, at that level it is, the amount it is, if other players end up with 400 wickets and 600 wickets and these sorts of things, whether Anderson continues to be thought of as that top level player in England as he is now, or whether there's, you know, there's a bit of a regression after his career. I find that sort of stuff, I find really interesting. The players who, you know, like Michael Clarke is and Mahela Jayawardene are really good examples of that, because I don't think going into the future they'll be mentioned in hushed tones, you know, and they've almost, whereas Kumar Sangakkara is always going to be mentioned.
Yes.
And I wonder where, I really do wonder where Jimmy is when it comes to legacy and that sort of thing.
I think he will achieve the hushed tone status in England, certainly. I mean, partly because, you know, it's going to be a long time.
Because people in Lancashire talk for
before anyone gets near it.
Except abroad.
Except, I think he'll probably last longer than Broad.
I mean, that's another interesting thing. If he outlasts Broad, that's almost another incredible thing in his career.
Well, I think Broad's action is maybe it takes more out of his body. Broad's also, yeah, he's been not that effective for 2-3 years, 2.5 years certainly.
And I know how he feels.
His last five was on the South Africa series. 3 wins ago now. Well, two wins ago now. So, whereas Anderson looks, particularly in home conditions, and given his, you know, his fitness record over the last, well, since he became a regular in the team in 2008, you know, he's, as you said, missed very little.
Yeah,
I think he could have another 3 or 4 years still. He could still be bowling 80 miles an hour with prodigious craft at the age of 40.
If he has another 3 or 4 years, then he almost has to become a great, just because he's basically a cockroach at that point. If he's a seam bowler who can play that late, considering that he also at one stage in his career bowled more seam balls than, you know, at Test level than anyone had ever done it in a long period of time, that's incredible. And also, I kind of want to know what he has for breakfast and like what his genes are, because there's already something wrong. He's one of the most lithe men.
Yes,
around, and I don't say that lightly.
No, that's coming from you, Jared. That is the ultimate accolade.
There are a couple of bowlers who are better than him in his era. There is no man more lithe.